I want to focus this morning on what is it which stops us. We've been trying, both Venerable Chanda and myself, we've been really trying so far to tell you what to do. Like, what is it works? What is it you should try to focus on? Because it's both the teachings of the Buddha and we have our own experiences. So if you try to do those things, that's our recommendation. But there is also things we're not supposed to do, which will stop us. So if you do those kind of things, they will hinder our development. And there is this verse or this poem in the old text, and it goes like this. There is no deep meditation for one without wisdom. And there's no wisdom for one without deep meditation. But for one with both deep meditation and wisdom, he or she is truly near nirvana. And nirvana is this state of basically the highest happiness available for a human being. So what the Buddha is saying is that you both need to somehow develop some wisdom and understanding, and we're going to dig a little bit into that now. And also you need to get your meditation going. And also the process of doing meditation is also developing wisdom. It's not that you just sit outside meditation and try to become wise. Also the process of doing meditation, there's a lot of learning, a lot of wisdom to gain by doing the practice. So they go together. So the question is, what is it that stops you from developing, and what is you can do so maybe you develop faster? And we can really waste a lot of time. I remember that for myself, especially in the past. You just end up getting into this habit. You do your thing. There's a few things you've learned. Maybe you got good into one type of meditation. You are in this space which you can handle in a good way, but you just stay there. And there's no kind of analysis of what you're doing or what you're doing wrong. You just keep hammering on and on and on the same thing, the same method, what you have learned. And I like this analogy of going into a room, maybe a dark room, and just you end up walking straight into a wall. And you try just to go through this brick wall. You bang your head and your body into this wall. You want to go through, but you can't go through. But if you just go a couple of meters to the left, there's a door. And you could easily go through that wall. So if you don't sit back and look at what you're doing and look for solutions and problems, and you just stand there and just banging your head toward this wall all the time, you can waste so much time. And if you do look at yourself and what you're doing and add in some perspective from, for example, from the Buddha, it can really help. And the Buddha had this framework of the five hindrances. And those are the five biggest hindrances for our development, our meditation. And I want to just talk about them. And there is some similes here, which I'm going to explain. And then there's some antidotes. What can you do if this is your problem? And the Buddha had actually two sets of similes. You can see here, there's like 10 pictures. In the bottom, there's like a bowl in which there's water inside. But the water is somehow, there's something in it. And then there's five like human conditions. And the simile in the bottom is when the Buddha used a bowl of water. And when the water is still and it's clear, you can see through it, and you can see deeply. And also, when the water is still, you can see a reflection of yourself on top of it. And that's what we are aiming for. We want to develop this insight about ourselves and the nature of ourselves. But if the water is like boiling, or is there a lot of plants in it, or it's a lot of movements, you can't see through. And the water here is a symbol of our mind. And then there is like five human conditions. One top left is like you have a debt. And then somebody is sick. And then somebody is in jail. And then somebody ending up like a slave. And then having to go on a journey. That's more or less in the past, though. But if you have to go through a journey in the desert, which can be a difficult journey. So I want to look at those five hindrances, explain the similes, and then talk about the antidotes. And maybe you also have some experiences which you can share. So the first of those hindrances is sensory desires. And that's the one in the top left and the bottom left. When we want to develop some topic, we always need to focus on that topic. And if we are to develop our mind, we have to focus on our mind, our mental, our inner garden. And the first hindrance is sensory desire. And that is always connected with this body and things outside. So the first hindrance is that we have sensory desires which actually pulls us away from the mind. And that's where we're supposed to focus, because that is where we want to do some development, and that's where we want to find some wisdom. So sensory desires pulls us away from what we want to do. And this is actually just any kind of satisfaction we are looking for in our eyes, hearing, touching, tasting, smelling. We have this desire for some kind of satisfaction. But also thinking about it. You can sit down and be still, but still you sit there thinking about the vacation you're going to do in 2 months. You're dreaming about this nice trip you're going to do in the future. You're not there yet, so your body can have the fun of going being on vacation, but you can still be there in your mind. So that is also part of this hindrance. Both the sensual desire itself and the thinking about it. And if you look at the simile in the bottom left, suppose there is a bowl of water mixed with lac, turmeric, blue dye, or crimson dye. Basically, a bowl of water where the water is mixed in with colors, dark colors. And when the water is colored, you cannot see through it. It's not clear anymore. And this shows how our sensory desires colors our perception. You can't see clearly. And now up in the top left corner, suppose there is a person who took a loan to undertake a business, and his business were to succeed, so he could repay all his money from the old loan and would be left with enough money to maintain his life. And this is pointing to this fact that there is a debt in the sensory desire. And what is this debt? The debt is that, yeah, you can have these sensory desires, but at one point, it will go away. Your dream vacation will last for 2 weeks, and then it's over. And you have to go back to work and all kind of responsibilities you have. So as soon as you get it, you automatically have this something you have to pay back. And also, it creates a longing for more. So you have been to this really nice vacation, and it's over. It starts this craving, I want to go again. Or I want to go to an even newer, better place. And all of this is taking you away from the focus of the mind. Just as debt must be repaid to gain financial freedom, sensory desire must be overcome to achieve spiritual freedom. It's not that sensory desires is kind of wrong or bad, okay? It's just that this is a hindrance. When we do this training of the mind, if we go overboard, it ends up like a hindrance for us. It takes us away from where we want to stay, where we want to focus. So what do you do? What is the antidote of sensory desire? What do you do? If you sit in meditation and you're dreaming about something, have you found any way out of it?
Just like see the satisfaction and also see it pass.
Yeah. And I remember I had this experience myself when I was a younger monastic in Australia. I had this routine that once a year I went back to Norway to see my family and friends. And normally when I'm back to Norway, I could ask my family, like, if there's something I wanted, something I needed. Then I could ask my family because they were always helpful. They wanted to buy something for me. So I remember a couple of months before I went to Norway, my mind started to... Let's see, what can I ask? And at that time, I just had this really strong desire for an MP3 player. This was the time before smartphones and all that stuff. So you had all these small devices, and there was something called Creative. They had this tiny little MP3 player. And my mind was just nagging and nagging. When I go back to Norway, I can buy the rah, rah, rah. I remember that the last couple of weeks before I left, I was actually tired of this craving. Can you please shut up? And then something really funny happened. I think it was the day before I was supposed to go to Norway. And then I did some meditation. And then I was like, okay, I'm going to Norway. And then suddenly my mind said, nah, I don't want one. I was like, what? You've been nagging for 2 months about getting this fancy MP3 player, and now you don't want it anymore? It's just like this little kid, this 5-year-old inside my brain, which doesn't... So it's impermanent. All this craving we have comes and goes. So, but at least the antidote, best antidote is actually when you get some really nice experiences in your mind, some really nice peace and some joy and some really, really delightful states. And the stronger those experiences are, so it's your own experiences, not just words, but you know how nice it can be to just be in the mind, to get your pleasure, get your satisfaction from your mind instead of your body. That is probably the best antidote. But when you start, it's a bit difficult when you don't have those nice experiences yet. So just continuing practicing, doing your best to develop, is a really good antidote. Just like you said, just going back to the breath, continue practicing. And of course, restraint, like we're doing here. There isn't much here triggering your sensory desire. Of course, there's a little bit, but it's pretty non-disturbing, sensory desire-disturbing environment, both inside and outside here. And that helps. And then, of course, when it comes to your meditation, please focus on comfort. So you sit, it's really nice, so you don't get this sensory desire. So you have to move your legs, or you have to change position, because that is also a sensory desire. So if you really put effort into sitting or lying or walking in a comfortable way, you will avoid some of the sensory desires which are disturbing in meditation. And I remember this. This is coming from my tradition here with Ajahn Brahm and Ajahn Chah. That was Ajahn Chah. That is my teacher's teacher. He said it. It's not the noise that disturbs you. Like this morning, could you hear the slamming of the door? Bang, bang. It's not. It's not the noise that disturbs you. you disturb the noise. We are the one who goes down there and get irritated or somebody's doing its very best to kind of create a beautiful retreat for us. They're probably coming with food and stuff and they're preparing the lunch. So there will always be disturbances around us. But if we go out, and like it's we who goes out and gets disturbed. If we can just leave it alone, it won't be a disturbance for us. So it's a really nice one. It's not the noise that disturbs you. It's you who disturbs the noise. So that's sensory desire. And sensory desire is something you overcome very slowly. Little by little by little by little by little by little. The second hindrance is ill will. It's basically negativity. And you can be negative to somebody else, a person. You can be negative towards yourself. And you can be negative towards your meditation object, your breath or your meditation or whatever you're doing. It's basically some kind of wishing to harm. You have this negativity. The simile here is the number two. There you can see there is a bowl of water which is being heated under fire and the water is bubbling. Suppose a bowl of water heated over fire, bubbling and boiling. And just as boiling turbulent water distorts reflections and hinders the ability to see through it, in the same way negativity will distort the mind's ability to see reality and prevent us from seeing reflections clearly. Boiling water, having a boiling mind, boiling angry, it distorts our perception. And then the second one on the top, somebody who is sick. Suppose a person was afflicted and seriously ill, and he had no appetite and his body had no strength, but later he would overcome his affliction and his appetite would return, and his body will regain strength. So Buddha likened ill will with being sick, physically sick. And what he's saying is that bodily illness, it weakens the body. In the same way, ill will and negativity weakens our mind. And it prevents from peace and clarity to arise. Negativity disturbs the mind just as illness disturbs the function of the body. How do you overcome ill will? Metta. Metta. Yes. Any other? What do you do when you are angry?
Take a break. Have a nap.
Yeah. Excellent. Any other means? Any other antidote?
When you look at it, you can feel it's quite disagreeable. It doesn't feel...
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Just as Vedamachandra said yesterday, this feeling of this ill will, it's not a pleasurable thing. It's like you don't really want that. And especially ill will, it's a really heavy... It's not fun. It's not fun to be full of negativity and ill will. And the antidote... When it comes to, if you are angry at somebody, one way of weakening that anger is just to remember that we all do mistakes. We all do stupid things and a lot of good things as well. So we can forgive if this is somebody else. So that will lessen our own kind of reaction to the situation. And then Ajahn Brahm, he had this, again, a nice way of putting it. You know, at least in Buddhism, we have this idea of karma. That basically meaning actions. And the idea of the law of karma is that what we do somehow will come back to us. I don't know when, but at some point. So if somebody does something bad and you get angry, maybe somebody does something bad to you and you get angry, Ajahn Brahm, he put it this way, you don't need to punish, karma will fix the bastard. So this idea of the law of karma is that if people do something bad, somehow it will come back to them. So we don't need to go in there and kind of punish them. They will get it anyway, if you take that as a truth. Do you have a question?
Anger is a punishment you put on yourself for other people's mistakes.
Yeah. So all these things will kind of help us to reduce this emotion of ill will and negativity in our mind. Yeah, and loving kindness is the big one, absolutely. It's the best antidote. If the negativity is to your meditation object, then you can also do like kindness or loving kindness to your meditation object. You can develop this friendship, this good relation to your breath or to your mind or to your visualizations or your mantra. It actually works. And then here's a quote from the Buddha. Hatred never ends through hatred. By non-hate alone does it end. This is an ancient truth. So that is ill will, a sickness. Third hindrance is sloth and torpor, which is like a state of where you lack energy and you just feel out of energy and drowsy. And that's the third one there, a bowl of water. Suppose there's a bowl of water covered with water plants and algae. So it's likened to a stagnant marsh water covered by plants and algae. So when the water is full of green plants and algae, you cannot see through it. And you cannot see a reflection of yourself. The other simile is being in a prison. Suppose a person was in prison, but later he or she would be released from prison, safe and secure, with no loss of property. And the point of being in prison is that you will be limited. So if you're put into a cell, and you have to stay there for so and so many weeks or years, you cannot move and you cannot do what you want. And sloth and torpor has the same function in your mind. It just hinders you to kind of move where you want to go in your spiritual training. It's just like you being in prison. Your practice is like imprisoned. It's just locked up. And you don't have the energy. You don't have this oomph to do anything, to get your practice going. So sloth and torpor limits one's mental and spiritual freedom, much like a physical prison limits the body. One is unable to engage in spiritual practices and enjoy mental clarity and energy. So what do? When you are like drowsy and just out of energy and you don't want to do it, what's the fix?
To go back to my motivation, so why am I interested in this in the first place? What is pulling me?
Yeah, basically adding a little bit of inspiration. Yeah, yeah, excellent. Anything else?
I would go outdoor, get some fresh air, and yeah. Maybe get some physical activity .
Yeah, absolutely. I think the biggest thing, normally, if you are just drowsy and out of energy, sleep. It's okay. It's kind of, recommended by experts. So if you're really drowsy and just, okay, go and have a nap. And the energy will come back to you. That's the big one. But inspiration is, of course, really, really important. Another thing you can do is perception of light. Going out is a really good idea. Out in daylight. Use your body a bit. It really helps your drowsiness. So if you sit here like, go for a walk, have a nap, and then come back and continue afterwards. So that's the third one. The fourth one is called restlessness and remorse, or restlessness and worry. So that's the fourth one there. A water bowl with water, which is moving a lot. And So restlessness is like a mental agitation where the mind is constantly seeking new stimuli and distractions. In Buddhism, we talk about this monkey mind. It's always jumping around from thing to thing. You never can sit still. That's this restlessness. But it also can involve remorse, because we're dwelling with what have happened in the past, and maybe we regret what we've done, and we end up with the remorse. But I think the biggest part here is this restlessness. So, and what is restlessness? It's basically a lack of contentment with what, where you are and what you're at. You don't like it where you are. And that's why your mind is just going somewhere else, because it's not good enough where you are. Your meditation isn't good enough. Your body isn't good enough. The place isn't good enough. So then you go somewhere else, hoping that that will be better. So you lack contentment with your situation right now. And you don't find joy and energy at that place. So you hope to find this happiness somewhere else. So suppose a bowl of water stirred by the wind, rippling, swirling, churned into wavelets. So that is the simile of the Buddha. If you're restless, just water was always on the move. And again, when the water is moving, like you can see there, you can't see through it. You can't see deep. And you can't see a reflection of yourself. And the other simile is a picture I found somewhere on the internet from the past. Suppose a person was a slave, not independent, but dependent on others, unable to go whenever he wants, but later he will be released from slavery, independent of others, a liberated person, able to go wherever he or she wants it. So being restless is likened to be a slave. And what is slavery? It's always being ordered around by some kind of slave master. Go and do this. Fix that. Go and make food for me. Go do that job. Constantly just ordering somebody around to do something. Never give you rest. Never give you freedom. So you never get to enjoy the free time and your life. So restlessness enslaves the mind, just as a slave is controlled by a master. So if you are restless, you are a slave. How do you handle restlessness? What do you do?
Using body scan when you start the meditation?
Yeah, focusing on the body. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Also, sometimes look at the same, observe it, and notice the feeling of resistance, and then sometimes using some discernment to see if I change, then will it be better? Similar, maybe, I think Ajahn Brahm says, like, then what? So, okay, so I'm not happy here, so then I move there.
Yeah,
and then,
yeah, okay. Yeah.
Then what? And then what about when I get tired of there, and then I move again? So kind of, thinking in the future of, will it be better if I move?
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, that is one of Ajahn Brahm's way of putting it. If you're not happy where you are, you want to go somewhere else. But then what? You come there, and you're not happy there either, and you have to go another place. And then what? And then what? And then what? It's just like there's no end to it. And the only end is just being happy with where you are, being content with where you are, because it doesn't lead you to the solution. So antidotes, restlessness, just as she said, body meditation with the body is a really good idea, because the body is quite a big and rough or coarse object. It's easy to focus on when your mind is a bit all over the place. Well, the breath is quite small and difficult to hang on to. Another thing you can do is just to simplify a bit your environment, just like we're doing here. So you minimize the input into your mind, which keeps you wanting to go somewhere else. A remorse part is like, this is remorse you have, this is something you've done, and feel this remorse. And it's just the same as normal. Everybody makes mistakes. You just have to realize you make mistakes like everybody else. And that will lessen a little bit that of that remorse you have. That's one way of doing it. Just forgive yourself. Nobody's perfect. I don't think it's possible to be perfect either. Basically, just follow the precepts. Just be a good person. So you don't, so it doesn't arise in the first place. Just work on your virtue, your speech, your action, your livelihood. If you can actually follow those training rules. So basically, the antidote to remorse is be a good person. But of course, when it still happened, what you do, you tried, and you still have remorse. I think just accept that we all make mistakes. And then the last one, that's this bowl here with some black, dark water. And that is doubt, and or uncertainty, maybe. I don't know what's the best word. It's basically not knowing what to do. You don't really know. So it can be doubt about yourself. Can you do this thing? Can you? Are you able to kind of, am I good enough? And can doubt the teachings. Is this the real teachings? Because another group said, this is the real teachings. And the third group said, no, 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 we are the one who have the right teachings. So you can doubt that. And you can also doubt the teachers. You can even doubt the Buddha. And you can doubt Nito, and you can doubt Chanda, and you can doubt all these teachers you know. And this doubt basically makes it difficult to trust this process, this training. And it makes it difficult to commit and really put in effort and do it. Really put effort into it and use some of your energy in life to actually practice. So doubt is like stopping you for doing it in the first place. And a simile here, suppose there is a bowl of water that is unsettled, muddy, and placed in the dark. That's like being full of doubt or uncertainty. And when it's placed in the dark, it's difficult to see. Muddy, it means that it's difficult to see through. You can't see deeply. And it's unsettled. Suppose a person, this is the last one, the desert. Suppose a person with wealth and property were to travel through a desert. And later, she or he arrived safely and secure without losing her or his property. So it's like going on a journey in the desert. This is like 2,500 years back in time. And they had to ride some kind of animal through the desert. And I don't think they had maps or Google Maps. It was really basic what I had. And walking through a desert could be difficult. And they can get lost. So the desert represents a waste, uncharted territory where one easily can get lost. In the same way, doubt can make one feel lost and unable to choose direction in your practice. And also, the desert is challenging, and especially without the map, the progress is slow and uncertain. So if you like, you want your practice, but you don't really know what to do, and what is the right thing, and who is the best teacher, and what's the best tradition, and just questioning yourself all the time. And just that questioning itself, it just stops you to get into it and do it.
You do some research on that, because to get to know a little bit more than that, more than what you know. Example, if it is Buddhism, and if there's a doubt, you read some sutta, or you check out some of the teacher's explanation of that sutta.
Yep. Yeah, excellent. Just getting more information and knowledge, reading, listening to some talks or YouTube channel or whatever. Mm-hmm. Just you don't understand, so get help from somebody who has some more experience and understanding than yourself. Mm-hmm.
I think that is a good question, and this question is, are you sure? In this way, if you think about situations, doubts, and then you can ask, are you sure about things? And then, of course, you never are sure about things, also not about things you doubt.
Yeah. Yeah. Basically, what he's saying, that doubt is also uncertain. And that's why I remember I said a few years ago, doubt the doubt until you understand. Just it's like the doubt itself is also uncertain. So you cannot doubt your doubt until you somehow know yourself. So it's a good point. Yeah.
I think also curiosity is something that sometimes helps you with doubt. Like it takes the pressure out. Like, let me just see. I'm not sure.
But
let's just try. Almost like adding a little bit of playfulness. Like you're just exploring.
Yeah.
Maybe it's true, maybe not. But
yeah. Just see. So it gets you into doing something, trying something. Yeah.
Try something and just see what happens.
Yeah. And not let you stop by all those thoughts.
Right.
And, yeah.
Not thinking, oh, but maybe it's wrong. Well, maybe it is, but that's
not
the point. Let's just see what it is.
Yes. Our capacity, our mind's capacity to understand and not have doubt is also a function of how the quality of our mind. So if our mind is really happy and peaceful and still, our ability to understand is much stronger. Your mind just works better. And very often it's like you have all these questions and you go on a retreat and you really rest and you meditate, let everything calm down. And during retreat, your mind just, here's the solution. It just pops up from somewhere. The solution to doubt, just to continue to practice and find some peace and calm, and then the solution will just, your mind can just come with the solution for you because you know it somehow deep down. It's very often you know the solution yourself. You just have to allow it to arise by making your mind beautiful.
Yeah, and then you sort of end up with, well, things take time. Have patience.
Yep. What is it? What does Buddha say? Patience is the highest, what is it?
Quality, spiritual quality.
Yeah. Patience is the highest spiritual quality. I think there's a lot of good input here. So if you're doubting yourself, there's one thing you can remember from the Buddha's teachings. He said that everybody can do this. And I mean all the way to full enlightenment. Except if you kill your mother and father. Have you? I don't think so. Or you have injured a Buddha. Or I think there's something about raping a nun. Something really bad. If you have not done that, if you not killed your mom and dad, you can do it. That's the advice from the Buddha. I remember that, like, if you doubt you can do it, there was this fun story from Australia with Ajahn Brahm, and probably some of you have heard this, but Ajahn Brahm was going to do a 9-day retreat. And in the beginning of the retreat, this Hell's Angels guy with this boom, 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 and with his like black leather jackets and a helmet, and he came driving down to the retreat center and parked outside the retreat center. And Ajahn Brahm's like, what's this? This is not like a Hell's Angels kind of meeting. This is a spiritual retreat. So Ajahn Brahm went over to him and asked him, like, well, is this your right place? And the reason was that this retreat center is placed on the same road as a prison. The prison is like a few kilometers up the road. So Ajahn Brahm thought that he came to visit some friends and he got to the wrong address. So Ajahn Brahm went up to him and said, okay, further up the road, that's where you're going, kind of thing. And he said, no. I've kind of registered for a meditation retreat, a Buddhist meditation retreat. So Ajahn Brahm was like, okay. And the retreat started, and he was just doing quite well. And actually, according to Ajahn Brahm, he was the one who got into, who did best. He actually got into deep meditation. So even though if you are a Hell's Angel fan and you're wearing all these tattoos, it's open. This training is open for everybody. And then also what I like to focus on is that if you doubt yourself that you can do this, also focus on your own experiences so far. Because that is something nobody can take away from you. Yeah, you had this nice experience half a year ago or 2 years ago. And you're like, wow, it's so nice. And just remember what you have managed to do so far. That will give you some self-confidence that, yes, you can do this. So just to finish off, that was the five hindrances the Buddha was presenting to us. And having these five hindrances in your mind while you're meditating can save you a lot of time. So if you get stuck, just have a break and look, okay, what's going on now? Is it sense of desire? Is it ill will? Is this restlessness? Am I kind of doubting something? So if you do some analysis of your meditation, then you can, that's it. I'm actually restless now. And what's the antidote to restlessness? And then you do something of that. And you can kind of solve the problem and get you going in your meditation.